Hello, everyone. This is Douglas Kretz. I'm the host of the BizSpark Show. This is the BizSpark Show that's brought to you by Microsoft. We are a division of people inside of Microsoft who work especially with entrepreneurs and startup founders. And we host a community of about 65,000 companies. We provide free software, free services, and cloud hosting, and access to mentors and great people and VCs, kind of like the guy who's sitting next to me. If you've been alive for about 20 years living in Silicon Valley or maybe more, you've probably heard of this guy. He's an author, speaker, and innovation strategist, worked with some of the largest companies in the world, and wrote a very famous book that we're going to talk a little bit about today called Crossing the Chasm. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to introduce you to Jeffrey Moore.
Nice to be here. Thanks for having me, Doug.
You're welcome. Yeah, I was really nervous to start because I've read your books, two of the books, Escape Velocity and Crossing the Chasm, and I know that every time I deal with someone who's really intelligent, I think, well, I hope I know a little bit about what I'm talking about because I'd hate to seem so ignorant. But I think we're in good company, actually, because this is all about starting up.
Yeah.
Right?
And everybody's making it up all the time.
Exactly. So this is all about iteration and renewing whatever you want to do in the world. So I want to get started with my first very basic question, which is, what is the chasm and does it even exist anymore?
Sure. So the chasm metaphor came out of disruptive innovations and how communities respond when they're asked to adopt a disruptive innovation. And a guy named Everett Rogers did the original work. And what you realize is there's like five different responses to a disruptive innovation, two of which are before the chasm, three are after. So the two before are the technology enthusiasts who just think it's just cool technology, who cares what it's for, just how does it work? And the visionaries who go disruptive, cool, I really want to disrupt this world and I want to get ahead of the game. The other three responses are much more, they're much more stakeholder responses. So the pragmatist response is, you know what, if and when this thing really works, I know it's a pain to shift to it, but I probably will because I can see there's a benefit. But let's not do it too early because a lot of times these are false alarms or false positives. That's one response. The conservative response, which is, you know, not again. You guys keep doing this to me. Every time you do it, I eventually have to do it. I hate it. Would you go away? Mm-hmm. And then the laggards who are going, you guys are actually instruments of the devil. and you know, we should just fundamentally, you know, ban you from the planet. So the chasm is between two and three. The visionaries who are the second response who want to go early, and the pragmatists who want to wait and see. And that creates a gap which is not bad for the visionary or the pragmatist, but for the vendor who had that initial success with the early adopters, They're going, well, where's my next year's sale? And the answer is, man, it's in the chasm. You're kind of betwixt and between. And so negotiating that chasm becomes really important for anybody who's got a disruptive innovation, because if you can't get across it, you'll have your early adopters and it'll never go beyond them.
And so I guess the better question would be, instead of does it exist, is that chasm bigger now? And the, what is the market like right now?
Really fascinating because one of the things that made it seem like, so the chasm was like very present in the 90s because largely the tech adoption was through businesses and institutions and governments. And it clearly in a B2B environment, the chasm is an ever-present phenomenon. What happened in the first decade of this century, though, was the internet came along with a consumer opportunity where the disruption to the consumer was minimal. Once you learned how to, you know, put your mouse over a URL, I mean, it was like, what's so disruptive? Mm. So there was a lot of disruption going on in the background, but not in the foreground. So you thought, well, maybe this chasm thing is done. Mm-hmm. So a couple things, and I think in a consumer world, there's a place where you say, no, where was the chasm for Facebook or Google or Twitter? Or it's like, I don't think there was a chasm there. So then you think, well, maybe it's over. What's happened in this decade is all of that consumer stuff is now coming back into the enterprise, mm-hmm. back into B2B world. So maybe now you could think of it as like B to B to C. It's a little bit of both. But the B2B part, the chasm's back in spades. And the venture community is investing more and more in enterprise IT, the consumerization of enterprise IT. Chasm is full-time present in that world because there's real risks that pragmatic people have to hesitate before they adopt.
Right.
Security risk, privacy risk, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, Those barriers, and sort of what keeps them from choosing, even if they want to choose, and how, you know, there are many, many startups that are pitching to the enterprise in this program. How do the entrepreneurs find those people who are on the edge and kind of want to adopt those things, and how do they get to those who aren't there yet? How do they cross the chasm in this kind of pushing things into the enterprise.
Yeah, it's a good one. So early adopters, the good news about early adopters is they're actually in search of disruptions.
Yeah.
So for them, the entrepreneur is like, this is my kind of customer, right? I tell him how disruptive I am. I tell him how wonderful I am. And they say, well, I have a project. I don't want to disrupt your industry. I want to disrupt my industry. Can I use your technology to disrupt my industry? Mm-hmm. So my favorite example of the early adopter distinction is Mark Andreessen and Jeff Bezos. So Mark was more of a technology enthusiast, really. He did Netscape. He wanted to change the way it worked.
He was a programmer by
trade. Yeah, he was. And by the way, Netscape no longer exists. It was bought by a company called Sun, which also no longer exists. That's one piece of it. Bezos had no particular commitment, I don't think, to the technology, but he thought, I can use this to revolutionize retail. Amazon still exists, by the way.
Yeah.
So that was the visionary guy who says, I'm going to use this for power. Now, that's great for Bezos, but if you're the person who's trying to sell it to the rest of the world, not so good. So then the next question is, who would be that next person? The most pragmatists are going to wait and see, but there's a class we now call pragmatists in pain. Mm. So pragmatists in pain are going, normally I would not adopt anything disruptive, but I'm in a very bad situation here. And if you could somehow use your technology to get me out of this thing, I'll put in with you now.
Yeah. Let me ask a question that I think comes up a lot in the circles of entrepreneurs that I hang around with, which is that if you were to ask questions and try to reverse engineer what people's pain is and try to figure out how to solve it, some people don't quite know exactly what to look for or what to ask for. When you talk to entrepreneurs, or from a VC position, when VCs talk to entrepreneurs, what would you coach them to do to actually discover what that real pain is? Because sometimes there's a little murkiness there about why something is not working and how it could work better.
If there's murkiness in it, it's too early to cross the chasm.
Okay.
The person on the other edge of the chasm has to be like in flames. There has to be like a burning platform. So what the entrepreneur is telling you is, I have not found a beachhead segment to cross the chasm for. By the way, the world doesn't guarantee you one. Mm-hmm. It's not like everybody's entitled to one. And it may be that you have to wait a longer period. Eventually, those other value propositions that feel kind of latent and murky will probably come to the fore, and people will realize, oh, I didn't know I needed TiVo, but now I guess I do need TiVo.
Yeah.
I didn't know I needed GPS. How could I now live without GPS? But the real question is, who would be the first adopter of GPS?
Yeah.
And maybe it was FedEx, or maybe it was, I need it for route management, or maybe it was limo drivers or whatever. But you're always looking for that sub-segment that has more skin in the game earlier.
So how do you find those people? I feel like in the media environment, in the sort of networking environment that entrepreneurs and tinkerers work in, it is hard to get to the people who have those answers, so to speak. How do you do it?
Well, we make this stuff up as we go along.
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, as the entrepreneur, you start getting desperate because you realize, I'm running out of cash. I've got to find somebody here. So you start asking the question a little bit more urgently. Part of it is, it's a little bit of a thought of experiment. You kind of know what your disruption can do. So you're trying to think, what process in the world is in big trouble right now that needs help? And sometimes you look at whole sectors. Like right now, for example, healthcare in the United States, it's going to need a bunch of help. It's just way too expensive. Education, it's going to need a bunch of help. Now, those are big institutions, but if you say, well, can I find a specific healthcare situation, a specific educational situation? Retail. Amazon has put every retailer on notice. If you guys don't figure this out, you're out of business. Mm-hmm. So now all the retailer guys, these are large economic forces that are shoving sectors of the economy toward the side of the chasm where they'd be reaching out to help an entrepreneur cross.
Yeah.
And if the customer doesn't help you cross, you're not crossing.
So let me put the question again in another way, because I'm looking at it from a marketing person's perspective. I'm looking at it as someone who spends a considerable amount of time sourcing for information, looking for leads in terms of who has information that I could use as sort of a community piece of information. We had talked about this earlier before we went online. I had asked a question on Quora, what do technology blogs not do well that they should? The implication being, or the sort of in between the lines there, that almost all tech blogs talk about the same things. Should should an entrepreneur be creating their own marketing platform to work on the thing or the industry that they want to disrupt? Or is that too much effort?
No, I think, I'm not sure, Mark, I don't know how much they'd have to build out the platform, but nobody's going to find your market for you.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you think about what a market's going to be on the other side of the chasm, it's not just you. You're going to show up with a micro ecosystem because the problem the customer has is specific enough to their industry. You won't have 100% of the solution. So you've got to get other people involved as well. So that means there has to be an economic pull that's strong enough that causes that ecosystem to form. And that pull comes from the customer. So the customer is getting increasingly desperate and increasingly looking for things. So one of the ways the customer might find you is somebody in that customer organization says, well, you know, I've heard of this crazy technology, blah, blah, blah. And the guy goes, look, I don't know if it's crazy or not, but get them in here because we're struggling.
We're desperate for you.
And so you get that chance. But when you come in, the customer, the prospect, does not want you to give them an hour demo of your product, right? What they want to know is, very quickly, tell me the kind of technology you have, and then I want you to stop talking, and I want me to tell you my problem, and I want you to listen. And I want you to listen thoughtfully, and then I want you to tell me, do you think your technology could break the back of this problem? Which is a very different thing. Most entrepreneurs are still, with early adopters, you know, it's a love fest. They get to talk about their technology. They get to talk about themselves. Yeah. This is a totally different call.
Yeah. I'm assuming, though, most entrepreneurs might lie or fib and say, oh, yeah, we can solve that problem.
And by the way, we believe sell yourself into trouble, work your way out. I mean, but what you don't want to do is lie in a way that ruins your company. But frequently the customers say, can you solve this? And the entrepreneur's going, well, yeah, with this and that and the other thing. But you know, the truth is, if you put yourself in service to a customer's problem genuinely, you know, you can usually find a way to solve it. Yeah. I mean, but what you have to do is realize it's not about you, it's about them. You are going to put yourself in service to their problem. And by the way, their problem is not your company. It's one application and even a kind of almost a corner case application of the thing that you actually want to create and take to the world at large. But for crossing the chasm, the more focused, the more on point you can be with a really, really compelling problem. We call it the compelling reason to buy.
Yeah.
And the thing that kills most companies is they've got a lot of target prospects who are interested. As you said, they have kind of a murky reason. They might have even a good reason, but they don't have a compelling reason. And so at the margin, they're going to give you a pilot project. They'll give you a little test here, but they won't really put anything behind you.
So this may sound ignorant, but let's say you have that first success with that major enterprise and you have sold something in there and solved a solution. Is there then another chasm that needs to be
Well, actually, the first major enterprise thing is more likely with a visionary.
Yeah.
It's more likely with the customer who goes, I see what I can do with this. And basically, they have a vision for you that might even exceed your vision for you.
Mm-hmm.
But they'll say, I'm going to bring you in. I'll sponsor you. I'll give you the project resources. So you do that one. This is where, and so you think, well, bye, I'm king of the world, right? If Procter & Gamble could be my customer, anybody could be my customer. It turns out, no. Procter & Gamble were the ones who were giving you this special visionary treatment. The pragmatists, you know, Unilever, Colgate, every other retailer going, well, I see you did it with Procter & Gamble, but do you really solve the problem I have? And they kind of put you through that test. And if you're not prepared to deeply immerse yourself in the domain of their problem, you're probably going to fail that test.
Yeah. This is very insightful instruction for anyone out there who is trying to build something revolutionary. There's a lot of talk about the mythical unicorn. I think even in the past month, there has been this sort of virus of blog posts that has moved through the ecosystem about it's very hard to fund a unicorn. One venture capital firm can find one, but then as you go through, different iterations of different types of companies, it's really hard to find that other unicorn. Do you think that the venture capitalists need to be focusing on that, and do you think most of them are? I mean, I know that they have to do that to survive, but I guess the question I'm asking is, should we get away with this idea of a unicorn and actually focus more on the problems of consumers, so to speak?
Yeah, I think the unicorn is some version of a media idea. I mean, the unicorn creates a spectacular economic outcome. Like a two or probably a three or a four sigma outcome. So you can't build you can't build your business, and venture capitalists can't build their business around four sigma outcomes, three or four sigma outcomes. Now, are you in search of that outcome? Sure you are. But so you want to be open to it, and that's great. But you've got to have something that's closer to a one sigma outcome thing. And the way I would present that is, do you think that the world's problems are pretty much solved? I mean, you've read the news this morning. How did it sound to you? Sounded a little bleak to me, frankly. Yeah. So I'm thinking the world's problems are not completely solved. Do you think technology can make a difference? And my impression is, almost in any problem in the world, technology can make a difference. Okay, so there is a market there, right?
Yeah.
So then the issue is where at the margin are you going to engage with that market in a way that is unique enough that the world would say, I'm willing to sponsor a brand new company in this area.
Yeah.
Because the big companies, frankly, the area is too new and too small, and they're not going to give it good attention. Mm-hmm. So only small companies will do it. But if you don't do that, if you just sort of say, you know, I'm an entrepreneur, I'm entitled to be funded, I'm entitled to get customers, well, no, you're not.
Well, but and here's the thing about the innovation environment that may have changed, right? I mean, what do you think of this? Now there are so many more smaller companies that can make these very cheap-to-build solutions. Can you talk a little bit about how that environment has changed and what the implications might be if you're trying to, if you're like the two guys we're going to talk to today?
It's okay. So I think, I think it's hugely beneficial to the world.
Yeah.
The ability to start a new company is very, very cool. I think there's no entitlement for those companies to create venture returns, but frankly, most of them don't need venture capital.
Yeah.
I mean, the venture capital was created because people had to go out and buy Sun servers and Oracle databases and Cisco routers and EMC storage. Well, guess what? Credit card and AWS, and you're off to the races, right? So I think that we need to reset our expectations about rewards. But if you want to like be involved with cutting edge technology, solve interesting problems, have your own business. You know, and you say, well, how big does that? If that business is $1 million a year and it's you and your buddy, is that okay?
I hope so.
Oh, well, I hope so too. But it's not okay for a venture capitalist.
No.
But it's like, will the world support that structure? You bet it will.
But and is that what's happening? Because you see now the rise of AngelList. You see the rise of like even I, who have never had any history in investing in companies other than investing in stock market, can put up $10,000, $5,000. And build somebody's future.
Well, what's very cool now with crowdsourcing is you can put up $500, right?
Yeah.
So I think what's very exciting about the new economy is there's a collaborative element that's come into business in the last 10 years. It's showing up everywhere. It's showing up in Uber. It's showing up with Airbnb. It's showing up with crowdsourcing. It's the collaborative infrastructure of everything. And what it does is it takes the peak three sigma, four sigma outcome off the table. You're not going to get a four sigma outcome with this method. But it takes the one sigma outcome and makes it much, much more probable and frankly more diffused across the society. So I'm really excited about the way in which the world economy can use the online world to reframe health, reframe, you know, welfare, the family, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Are enterprises in flames looking on crowdfunding platforms, and are they looking at AngelList for solutions to their products, or do you think they know?
No, I think enterprises in flames need something more strongly backed than that.
Yeah.
Only because they're going to put so much pressure on the solution providing institution.
So more bespoke, basically.
Yeah,
it's
going to be really catered
to that issue.
And by the way, enterprises in flames, interesting distinction. The visionary wants to be the only one who gets your technology. The pragmatist in pain wants everybody else in their category to have exactly the same thing they have so that we can all make it better together. So you have to at least be a big enough company to serve their entire segment, and you have to have enough institutional strength to be. So you have to be a $10 million company. You probably have to be a $50 million company. You don't have to be a $250 million company, and that's probably the upper limit of where you could take a niche market.
Yeah.
And then if you want to be a venture return company, eventually you have to get out of one segment and get into multiple segments and go elsewhere.
Wonderful stuff. So now we're going to actually turn it over to entrepreneurs themselves. We have two today that we're going to talk to. We're going to start with Asim Badshah, who runs a company called Socito, which is a B2B company. And Asim, we'll let you take it from here and just describe to everybody, first of all, the audience, what you do, what your company does, and we'll let you ask Jeff a question.
Sure, thanks, Doug. So Cito is essentially a B2B social media platform that lets businesses find their ideal target customers and then start an engagement with them so that they can then be directed to a sales team to close the sale. Jeffrey, my question to you is, you know, what do you do when you're going after a market that today is kind of full of early adopters? You know, we sell to people who are doing B2B marketing, who are already on social media, and are in most cases doing content marketing. So today that's still kind of full of early adopters, but as we go along here, we think that more and more companies are going to be in that space. Does the dynamics of crossing the chasm change in that scenario?
It's a great question. So I do think that is still a pre-chasm market, which means at the margin, people who are seeking competitive advantage and want to get ahead of the herd are going to be your natural customers. What'll happen at some point is if enough of those customers have success, they'll actually create a threat to the remaining customers who have not adopted. And what'll happen to your marketing is it'll go from accentuating the positive to actually accentuating the negative, which is really weird for a marketer who works for you, because the last 2 years of my success, if I work for you, is all about, look at the amazing things you can do with this technology, look how it can improve your top line, look how it improves your brand image, blah, blah, blah. And then all of a sudden you're going to a pragmatist and you're saying, you know, dude, if you don't get on this bandwagon, you're toast, because now your customer believes that you never listen to them, whereas every other company is listening to them, and they talk about you on Twitter and you don't answer. So what's the matter with you? But all of a sudden it's weird. Pragmatists actually respond to the negative case much more responsively than visionaries respond to the positive case. And both make sense, but it's just weird if you've had all the success accentuating the positive to all of a sudden say, this is really marketing? I mean, I'm making my customer prospect feel bad? And the answer is, yeah, it's kind of like, does it hurt here? Does it hurt when I, oh, it hurts. Oh, okay, then that must be where I'm supposed to press. So it's, and I think you will find at some point, if not this year, and I don't know, you kind of have to let the market develop for a certain distance. You'll find at a point where people go, you know what, I'm losing out. I'm losing out because I'm not playing the social media game correctly. And I'm watching my lunch get eaten by people who are. And that's what will cause them to move. But until that happens, you have to still work with the early adopters and maybe try to get them to expand. All the other thing you'll find is your customers are early adopters, but it might only be one department and one group inside that company. And so you can even kind of have a mini crossing the chasm inside that one company to go to another division or another group. Yeah.
Well, thank you. Do you have any follow-up questions for Massey?
No, that was great. Thank you.
Okay. Cool. Thank you so much for joining us. And we go to the second caller now is Rashid Garg, who runs a company called Nine Slides. And when we bring him up, hello, Rashid. How are you?
Hi, Doug. Hi, Jeff.
Why don't you introduce your company very briefly, just like Asim did, and then ask your question for Jeffrey.
Sure. So my name is Rashid, and I'm founder CEO of Nine Slides. At Nine Slides, we allow users to easily add audio-video narration to the PowerPoint slides so that you can easily tell the story behind your presentation slides to your online audience. And my question is, given the presentation is such a wide user base, how do I price my product and capture into all the markets? Because we currently have users from individual teacher in Minnesota to Fortune 500 in Australia.
It's a great question also. And this is evolves a model that actually came up in more in the Escape Velocity book than the Crossing the Chasm book, where we talk about at scale, companies have two business models that work at scale. One's called the volume operations model, where you might have, you know, millions of customers giving you $10 a month. And at the other side, there's the complex systems model, where you might have hundreds of customers giving you $1 million a year, right? And both models work. The pricing models in those two worlds are wildly different. So in the high volume market, which is where I suspect you're starting, pricing has to be completely transparent, and basically it's a fixed price and typically a low price, and increasingly a freemium model is very frequent, where you say, look, I don't really want to charge a teacher money, but I wouldn't mind charging a school district money, right, and that kind of stuff. Well, the school district is more of the complex system, and the teacher is more of the volume ops end user. So, but companies at the end of the day have to decide at some point, not right at the beginning, but at some point you're going to make a decision. Am I going to end up going down the consumer path or the enterprise path? Salesforce.com is a great example. When they came out in 2000, it was unclear whether they were going to go up or down. Initially, it looked like they were actually going to the volume market, and they were saying you can get free users or $65 a month or whatever it was. It became clear after a while that they ended up going to the enterprise side. If you go to the enterprise side, pricing has to be opaque, meaning no two companies ever pay the same amount. And the way it becomes opaque is you bundle the core service or the atomic service with a lot of other services and products, and you create a much bigger thing to buy, which speaks more to the specific bespoke interests of that company. And so even though it might be built on the same, it'd be like saying the difference between Google search for me as an individual and if Google sold search to the NSA. Not that the NSA needs any more help, but if they did. So I think you're right now still early days. Right. I wouldn't worry too much about it. I think in your heart of hearts, though, at some point you're going to have to make the decision, do I see this as something that I want to sell to to Goldman Sachs for every one of their, pitches to companies to take them public? Or do I want to say, no, I really think this is more democratic? And so one way would be the way of Google and Apple, and they clearly are in the volume ops camp. And the other would be more like the way when Lotus Notes took something, or they clearly went to the enterprise when they went their way. But at the beginning, when you looked at it initially, it could have gone either way. So right now, I think whatever pricing model you have, I wouldn't try to optimize on it yet. I'd worry more about, can I build viral adoption? If I'm going to play the volume model in particular, can I engage people and enlist them and get them involved? And the pricing will come. Remember, Facebook, Google, and Twitter had no economic model forever, and they built this huge viral response. Or if you say, you know what, no, this is too specialized an activity, it's never really going to go that viral. If you went the other way, then you say, oh, okay, now let's talk about then sales teams or marketing teams or even education teams, like I want to train people or I want to educate people about health risk or whatever. And then I would take your technology and package it with more services and say, let's build something specifically for tutoring an airplane mechanic or helping somebody pass the SAT or something like that.
You know, the thing that's really striking about this, and I think both of our entrepreneur guests can probably weigh in on this, is that it's kind of ironic that all of the real marketing and the real crafting of the services that you're either going to pitch to a consumer or to enterprise are very hands-on experiences. Like, there's no way to just set up a shop window and say, hey, look, we're going to... How do you coach entrepreneurs through that? I mean, I think everybody wants to go to scale very quickly, but it seems like to get really good growth, you have to spend a lot of hands-on time working on this stuff.
Well, it's interesting. So the volume ops, one of the things that's been really cool about the web, it actually caused us to make the nuke. By the way, my 30-second pitch is Crossing the Chasm is coming out with a third edition.
I was
this
going to
month.
Say this.
That's cool. That's cool. This month on January 28th. And one of the points I want to make is it's all new examples from the 21st century. So that's cool. But the second thing is there's two appendices, and one of them is called The Four Gears. And it's for just B2C. Like, there is no chasm, Jeff. This is a B2C pure play. But in The Four Gears, we talk about acquiring, engaging, converting, and enlisting. And when you think about the financial investor, they're saying, well, how much traffic can you acquire and how can you convert them? At what price can you convert them? But it turns out what the value creation gears are the other two gears. How much can you engage them and how much can you enlist them in this project of yours? And so I think the entrepreneur in the volume ops thing has got to spend a lot of time on engagement and enlistment. And the truth is, at least with some of these examples like Facebook, like Google Search, you just keep iterating. You try stuff. When Facebook figured out you could post a photograph and change things, it changed social media forever, right? When YouTube, who thought post videos? I mean, how that can't be popular, right?
But you know what's interesting about the YouTube example is those guys were solving their own problem. They weren't solving someone else's problem.
Well, that's like Napster was solving his problem, right? So yeah, all these things.
This is what I think. I think where my point is, it's like you mentioned very early on that something has changed, right? That now things are sort of tiding back over towards selling to the enterprise. But in that kind of system, It goes back to that question of how do you find these people and how do you engage with them? Because there is no artful way to, there are no platforms, I think, where you can make that engagement easy, because all those CRM solutions and ERPs and all that stuff is all already in the enterprise. It's like it's very expensive for entrepreneurs to find this. So do they just rely on Twitter? Do they just rely on?
I got you. So I do think there are two. I think there's a path for the digitally, there's a generational thing going on right now, which is people under the age of, I'll say 35, something like that, are digitally native, and people over the age are digitally immigrants, right? So I do think there's been a period, and it's probably winding down, where just being your own best customer, kind of the way Steve Jobs was his own best customer. If I think it's cool, other people will think it's cool, and I can use the digital environment I don't need to have connections. I don't need to have any special connection to the enterprise, because it's a volume play. And if I can, if I can capture the imagination of a social group, whether it's my age cohort or something like that, I can do it. But on the enterprise side, the barrier you're talking about is very real. Yeah. This is a place where I think venture capital, formal venture capital, really pays its way or doesn't. The thing that a venture capitalist should do is say, I get your technology. I can see how it can cross the chasm. I can even think of the, or with your help, we'll figure out together where to cross. And then my board or my connections, I can get you meetings with the key people. And basically, I need to get you somewhere between 10 and 20 meetings for you to close between 4 and 7 deals. And after that, the segment will self-educate itself about it. That formal venture capital in Boston and in Silicon Valley and increasingly now in other places, but in those two places, that's their number one value add.
That's amazing. And what I would recommend, and we're going to close out the show, is I would recommend that you entrepreneurs out there buy the new edition of Crossing the Chasm, and then maybe throw some of that stuff into your pitch to VCs if you get to the point where you want to make that discussion. I think that would be really valuable. I think the stuff that is in that book can really open your eyes.
Yeah. That's the audience that it was created for.
Great. Well, thank you, Jeffrey Moore, for joining us. Thank you, Rushit Garg, for joining us, and Asim Badshah. We'll be back in the next couple of weeks with some more shows. And if you want to watch the archive of this, just stay on the live stream channel. It'll also be put on Channel 9 later. If you want to reach out to me, you can always reach me at Douglas Kretz on Twitter or at BizSpark on Twitter. And we take all your questions, and we're always engaging with you. It's been a pleasure, Mr. Moore.
Oh, thanks, Doug.
And good luck with the sales of the new edition. I appreciate you being here.
My pleasure.
Bye, everybody.